You've probably seen the pictures of the Ku Klux Klan at the peak of its power in the United States. That was in the 1920s. There's one famous picture of a big Klan march in Washington, D.C., with the U.S. Capitol building in the background. There are plenty from our part of the world, including a Klan march in Ashland. It's shocking to people who live in liberal Ashland today, but there it is. Oregon was a hotbed of Klan activity in the 1920s, peaking with key Klan figures controlling parts of state government. This is all covered in the book by Linda Gordon called The Second Coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s and the American political tradition. Linda Gordon is a historian, feminist, teacher, and prolific writer. She's won the Bancroft Prize for writing on American history twice for her books on the photographer Dorothea Lange and the abductions of orphans from Mexican Americans in Arizona. The Second Coming of the KKK first came out in 2017 and in paperback the following year. Linda Gordon, thanks for joining us on your return tour with the book.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Sure. Now, the topic is still rather confoundingly fresh, isn't it, in American politics?
Unfortunately so. Although, as with many historians, writing a book takes a long time. And so when I started this, our situation was not then like it is now. So it's almost as if it became a little prescient.
Right. But so talk about the politics of resentment and what were the things that were being resented back then in the teens and 20s?
Well, first of all, the first thing I want to say, that just to make people understand what I'm talking about, is that the 1920s Ku Klux Klan was a mass movement. It had somewhere between 3 and 5 million members. One of the things that came as a surprise to me is that my hometown, Portland, Oregon, was one of the Klan's strongest cities. Now, this Klan was responding in many ways more to immigration than it was to traditional anti-black racism. In 1920, actually, there was only a very small proportion of African Americans who lived in the North. This Klan took out after Catholics and Jews. And it was also, in many ways, a Protestant evangelical organization whose members considered those religions, Catholicism and Judaism, to be, sinful and not the proper way to worship God.
Wow. So, how successful ultimately was this mass movement? It seems like many of the things that the Klan wanted in the 1920s did become law.
Well, they had two kind of specific political victories. One was the 1924 Immigration Restriction Act, the first act that created across-the-board limits on who could immigrate, and it was based on a set of quotas in which the people considered proper, like, for example, European Protestants, and the people that were considered not proper were not only Catholics and Jews, but anybody that we might consider today people of color. For example, England had a quota in the tens of thousands. The quota for all of sub-Saharan Africa was 100. The Klan, of course, was not the only force behind this. There was a long history of racist anti-immigration stuff going on in the States. But the Klan did play an important role in getting it through Congress because the man who shepherded it was a member of the Klan, Alfred Johnson. That law was in effect until 1965. The other specific thing is that also in 1924 at the Democratic Convention, the leading candidate for the presidential nomination was Al Smith, who was the governor of New York. But Al Smith was a Catholic. The Klan, who had many, many members in that convention, went all out and managed to defeat him. But I do want to say that in many ways, I think the greatest victory of the Klan was not these specific political events, but was managing to really normalize and make respectable their bigotry. They of course there had been bigotry in this country for a very long time, but what was going on is that it was magnified and promoted. The Klan had something like 150 print publications it used to spread its ideas across the country.
And how much were the media features of the time part of that? I mean, you mentioned the newspaper, certainly, but for example, the legend that the film Birth of a Nation by I can't remember the director's name right now, how big was the Birth of the Nation and the rebirth of the KKK?
Well, the Birth of the Nation came about in 1915, and the Klan did not really get organized to take off until 5 years later. And that's an important lesson because it points out that it's not the Klan that created this virulent racism, but the Klan then used the film widely to recruit and also to raise money. They had hundreds, possibly thousands, of showings of Birth of a Nation around the country. I also think there's a subtle and interesting thing going on in Birth of a Nation, and that is that it is basically a racist screed against African Americans, whereas the Northern 1920s Klan was not emphasizing African Americans. Nevertheless, I think what it shows us is that bigotry can be part of a whole approach, a whole, what someone has called a structure of feeling, so that even if anti-black racism was not the major motivating factor, it fit into what you might call a family of bigotry.
The other shoe, by the way, on Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith was the name that was escaping me here. But let's talk some other people who were more central to the Klan's success. It seems like there's always a spellbinding speaker in any mass movement, and it looks like David Stevenson was that for the early Klan of the 20s. Tell us about him, Linda.
Yeah, David Stevenson was the Grand Goblin, as they called it. They love these kind of names, of the state of Indiana. And he was an extreme case, but at the same time, he was kind of symptomatic of something that was going on about Klan hypocrisy. The evangelical orientation of the Klan meant that they were big supporters of prohibition, big enemies of evolutionary theory, and especially strong insisters on a proper sexual morality. David Stevenson was often a drunkard. He was notorious for his attacks on women and his sexual harassment of women. This is common in the Klan, is that you have these principles, and then you have people who are not living up to them. Stevenson actually came to a very precipitous fall because one of his attacks, in which he kidnapped, raped, tortured, and then murdered an assistant, actually got him convicted of murder. And you know, the Klan was mainly nonviolent, but not exclusively nonviolent. And what was unusual about David Stevenson was that he was convicted. To the best of my knowledge, in the 1920s in the North, not a single Klan member was ever convicted for any violent act.
You know, the statement you make in the book about the Klan and the fact that it did seem to have differences in how people approached the stuff that the Klan was spouting, that its beliefs was riddled with contradiction. But to some degree, were those still effective mobilizers? Was it the fact that people felt like they did have some wiggle room?
Yes, I do think so. I think that the Klan, well, some people would consider it part of an evangelical Protestant revival. I think it was an evangelical Protestant revival. The Klan never had made inroads into, for example, the Protestant churches that are today called sometimes the mainline churches, like Episcopalianism or Lutheranism. But at the same time, I think it was the Klan's genius to be able to marry its rhetoric of of evangelical Christian morality to a kind of bigotry that was not only saying that the white race was the superior race and the only race that should be allowed to run America, but also that this particular kind of religion was superior to all others.
It's almost a religious function then. I mean, did the Klan substitute church for some of its members?
To some extent, but actually more, it brought Protestant congregations into the Klan. The Klan claimed to have 40,000 ministers as members, and I want to say I never believe any of their figures. I think they exaggerated all the time, but we do know that there were thousands of ministers who not only praised the Klan in their sermons, but who actually urged their members to join. And this was at its peak with the big tent evangelists that you sometimes saw in the West, like, for example, Amy Semple McPherson. Many of these people were either Klan members or openly Klan supporters.
There's an interesting mix of secrecy with the 1920s Klan because, you know, the covered faces, and I should point out, it's interesting that they were so anti-Catholic because those hats do tend to look like bishop miters, but let's not go there. But covered faces appeals to a wide public, though. There's a contradictions even in the reception that the Klan got, it would seem.
Yeah, in fact, another aspect of their genius, though I don't know how deliberate it was, is that they got the best of being public but also secret. They were completely public in terms of advertising, open meetings, trying to recruit, having huge outdoor July 4th extravaganzas. But at the same time, in the chapters, which were called claverns, they attracted people through producing a whole lot of kind of abracadabra occult ritual. There were secret codes. There were secret names. And the members were required to swear a really terrifying oath that they would never reveal any of those to non-members. And so you have this kind of double whammy in which they're very open, but on the other hand, it becomes extremely attractive to many people to be an insider, to be privileged with the knowledge of these secret rituals.
Linda Gordon is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Second Coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s in the American political tradition. You can join our conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Steve in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. And thanks, Linda. I have three questions. It was my understanding that the KKK selected Oregon to be the white state for some reason, and I don't know if that was a concerted effort across the country that they were going to move to Oregon and make that a white state or not. And then the second question is, we in Grants Pass used to have the sundown law, just like everybody else in Oregon, and it was just removed from the books not that long ago, actually. I didn't know if there's any towns that still had those on the books in Oregon. And the third question is the John Bircher Society. I know it's an anti-communist thing, but I didn't know if they were affiliated with the KKK or not.
All right. All good questions. Thanks for those, Steve. Appreciate that.
Sure. Great question. You know, Oregon has an old, old, long history of bigotry and racism. It was a state that I don't have the dates in my mind, though you can find them easily in the book. It was a state that literally tried to prohibit non-white people from entering. It was a state that passed what were called the Alien Land Laws, which prohibited people of color, but in this case particularly Chinese and Japanese immigrants from owning land. So it's very important to understand that the Klan did not invent bigotry in Oregon, but it, on the other hand, it made use of it, and that legacy was part of what made it so strong in Oregon. And one of the puzzling things is that people in Oregon could get worried and angry about Jews, for example, when the number of Jews in Oregon was, if I remember the number correctly, was 0.03%. The vast majority of Oregonians had never met a Jew. And Catholics were also a tiny minority. So there was a fertile ground there. Then the Klan used it, and it also became the only state to pass one of the Klan's favorite pieces of legislation, which was to ban parochial schools. I think the second question was about what's going on today.
Sundown laws, whether they're still on the books, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not up to date on that, but I rather doubt it, since I think there's been a lot of litigation about that. Now, what was the third question? I forgot.
It was about the John Birch Society and whether they had allies in the KKK.
Oh, yeah. There's a tremendous continuity between the Klan and groups that arose later. For example, in the 1930s, when there were about over 100 fascist groups in the United States, I'm talking about groups that are openly call themselves fascist, and many, many of those rose directly from the Klan. And that may be true about the John Birch Society. I have not studied that. But, of course, whenever you have this kind of tradition, it also evolves and changes. Because, for example, the American fascists who grew out of the Klan were not particularly religious at all. And furthermore, the Klan had been very anti-Catholic, whereas the fascists completely dumped the anti-Catholicism to focus 100% on Judaism. Then there's the question of communism, which obviously comes up when you think about the John Birch Society. The Klan, interestingly enough, did not much harp on communism. They were certainly anti-communist, but it was not their main thing. It was in the 30s when you have the American fascists, and their attitude is that communism is a Jewish plot. All Jews are communists. All communists are Jews. So you have an evolution of these bigoted ideas, but they do change over time. Still, I would say that there is, and I think a while ago I used the word a structure of feeling. I think these kind of movements, and that's what we're seeing today, they draw on their ability to rev up fear and anger. And in a way, the emotional basis of these movements is often more important than their particular ideologies.
Well, and I do find myself wondering, without getting too far out of my armchair as an armchair psychologist, about the sense of belonging, you know, the correspondence between the Klan and the gangs and other groups that essentially replace families for some people on one hand, and the other hand, knowing some quote-unquote truth that the rest of the world doesn't know.
Yeah, you know, I think when social movements are strong, it's often because they do provide a very strong sense of community. That was true of the Klan. There was a women's Klan that itself had 1.5 million members. There were youth groups. They had these very large outdoor picnics with games and entertainments for all members of the family. Now, when you get to the fascists, though, this is a little more tricky because the fascists were extremely violent and therefore they were really breaking the law and therefore they were dependent on certain levels of secrecy. And furthermore, let me just say one other thing. There were many, many small groups, and that is similarly the case today with the white nationalists that we're talking about, a bunch of small groups. And I would say that that's, from my point of view, both good news and bad news. The good news is that they don't unite and become more powerful as a larger organization. But the bad news is, and this was true of the fascists then, and I think of the white nationalists today, is because they have all these small groups, there's no discipline. There's nobody to stop them from just, you know, doing whatever little bits of violence they, and sometimes not little bits, their members feed on. Furthermore, the white nationalists, by and large, have a disproportionate number of very young men, men itching for a fight. That was not true of the Klan. It was very, very much a family organization. So you have this kind of, on the one hand, on the other hand, on the one hand, it's a good thing that the 1920s massive Klan was mainly nonviolent, but it's the bad thing that their contribution was to normalize bigotry and to shout it from the rooftops without any constraint on what they said.
We're talking about Linda Gordon's book, The Second Coming of the KKK. Linda, did Oregon represent the high mark in political influence for the Klan in any state? Did any state come close to Oregon in that level of Klan involvement?
Yeah, well, it was very strong. Probably the state with the largest per capita membership was Indiana. And that's a little tricky because Indiana is in part a southern state. And so the old southern anti-black, extremely violent Ku Klux Klan had a lot of influence in Indiana. Oregon, which was the second strongest state, is a different story because it didn't have hardly any African Americans. It didn't have that that legacy, and that worked for them with their enormous involvement in anti-Catholicism and anti-Semitism. I already mentioned the fact that it was the only state in which they succeeded in passing the prohibition on parochial schools. That was overturned by the Supreme Court a few years later. But it's also true that you have to look at where the most able organizers were. And from what I saw, I looked at some of the people that were organizing the Klan in Oregon, notably a man called Luther Powell, and many, many ministers, really grew it a lot because of their ability. They were charismatic speakers. It was kind of this hellfire threats about what was going to happen to you if you were sinful and so on. It was a shock to me to discover this about Oregon because when I grew up, I came to think of Oregon as one of the more liberal states in the country. I think with those of us who follow what's been going on in Oregon recently don't have that illusion. And I bet if someone really wanted to study it that you would find some direct lines of inheritance, so to speak, connecting the Klan there to contemporary racist right-wingers in Oregon.
So the DNA is still there. About a minute left here, and I just want to ask about the legacy in addition to the obviously some of the ideas going on. Did the Klan itself decline in power because of the fact that it got some things done, like helped the 1924 immigration law get passed?
I think possibly, but actually I think the major reasons were internal. As I mentioned before, there was a lot of corruption, and the Klan was very expensive to belong to. They were constantly soaking members for dues and special fees and trying to sell trinkets and so on. And so a lot of members came to resent that. But I think also this whole ritual secret stuff, for a lot of people, it was kind of fun for a few months, a year, when you first started doing it. And after a while, it became old hat, and I did find comments by former Klan members who said things like, "I feel like the only thing this organization wants to do is to get my money." The 1920s Klan was a for-profit corporation.
Interesting.
And
okay.
The level of corruption was very, very significant. Leaders were spending this guy David Stevenson that you mentioned mm-hmm. before used Klan money to buy himself an elaborate yacht, which he kept on Lake Erie.
Yikes! One of many stories told. Linda, we're out of time. I'm going to have to stop us here.
Sure.
The book is The Second Coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and the American political tradition. Linda Gordon, thank you so much for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you.